This is Rabble Radio, recorded on Friday, December 6, 2024. I'm your host, Breanne Doyle. Thanks so much for tuning in. Rabble's got its finger on the beat of the issues that matter to you. If you're curious about the latest news in Canadian politics, labor, environment, or social justice, you've come to the right place. This is news for the rest of us, free of corporate influence. This week on the show, Rabble's labor reporter Gabriella Kaluge-Kasuga talks to Amy Blanding to discuss her recent departure from Northern Health after expressing her own personal solidarity with Palestine, and what the future of diversity, equity, and inclusion might look like. Here is that conversation. Take a listen.
Thank you so much for joining us on Rabble Radio today, Amy.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Just to start off, can you tell me a bit about your time working at the Northern Health Authority and how your employment there ended?
Sure. So I was an employee at Northern Health, which is in the northern interior and northern part of the province of British Columbia. For 6.5, almost 7 years. I had various roles at the organization. The last role that I held before leaving the organization was the Director for Inclusion, Diversity, Equity, and Accessibility. I held that role for the better part of a year. And I was the first person to hold that role for the health authority. It was a new portfolio that we were basically designing from the ground up, and doing equity work, health equity work, both to influence the employee experience, so supporting equity-deserving folks and removing barriers to access and equity for staff of the health authority, so thousands of employees, and also for the patients and families that we serve, the community that we serve, which includes 55 First Nations communities, 11 Chartered Métis communities, and a geography the size of France, all the way west, I guess, to Haida Gwaii, north to the Yukon border, east to the Alberta border, and south to Williams Lake. So quite a vast region. So I worked in that position. The incidents that caused my eventual departure from the health authority, I'm also a musician in my personal time, I guess you could say, although I do that professionally as well. And I was contracted to play a community concert back in April with a choir. My music is protest folk. Basically, it's a lot of it is political in nature. And the choir that I was slated to perform with took question with some of the contents of my music and my set list. And ultimately, it asked me not to perform a song that I had written about the genocide in Palestine, which I chose to do anyway. So I performed a song, it's called Sunbirds, and I also wore a shirt at the dress rehearsal for that concert with a watermelon on it. It was a fundraiser shirt for Wear the Peace, which sends humanitarian aid into Gaza. And so those two actions and me posting about it on my social media ultimately led a community group of a couple of folks who identify as Jewish in the Prince George community to send a letter to my employer stating that those behaviors of mine caused them to feel unsafe. They used language that I was pro-Hamas, anti-Semitic, bigoted, that I went on ignorant rants and I couldn't be trusted to work with minorities. All of this information is public, by the way, if anyone's interested in accessing it. But the health authority decided not to investigate the accuracy of the claims stated in the letter and instead chose to remove me from my position as Director of Inclusion, Diversity, Equity, and Accessibility. There are other aspects of it that were involved, but ultimately I was required to post a pre-written apology to the entire Jewish community in the Northern Health region on my personal social media. And when I asked for time to reflect on whether or not that was something I was willing to do, I was told that counted as a refusal and I was removed from my role. Subsequently, over the past guess now we're in month six. I engaged in legal action against the health authority and then filed a lawsuit against Northern Health on October 9th. And I also filed a lawsuit against the community members who sent the defamatory letter to my employer. And so we will be going to court and taking this to trial. I've sued for violations to my charter rights, for wrongful dismissal, and for defamation, injury, and damages.
Yeah, and I'm sorry you had to go through that, for
Thank you.
wearing a watermelon shirt and singing your song. What was your reaction? Like, what was your emotional state kind of going through that, and what was going through your head while all this was happening?
Well, initially it was pure shock. I've been working in equity work for a very long time now, so I'm not regularly surprised by how oppression and power rears its head. But in this instance, it really did take me aback and has been emotionally, physically, and psychologically one of the most difficult things I've gone through. It has major financial implications for me, having lost my job, as anyone can attest, trying to keep up a livelihood in these times is difficult. So the financial repercussions, this has ultimately pivoted the entire trajectory of my career, being able to find other employment in health equity work, but more so the impact that this has on my integrity, on my family's well-being, for my community, and for anyone who's interested in, dismantling systems of oppression. This is just another example of how folks are getting away with absurdities and distracting us from the actual problem, which is that there's a genocide happening in Palestine, in Lebanon, in Syria, and we're paying attention over here to some benign song that a privileged white woman sang on stage to give voice to her pain and her, what she wanted to share in her community. Yeah, so it's been incredibly trying and incredibly emotional, for sure.
Yeah, I can imagine. And thank you for sharing what you've been through despite going through a lot emotionally with all of this. You said something interesting that I kind of want to unpack. You mentioned it's not often that oppression or forms of oppression surprise you, but this time it did. What was it about this specific instance that, shocked you?
I think what's really shocking is when we hear it often, but in this instance as well, a lot of folks are comfortable admitting their ignorance around particular topics or political events. Or a lot of folks, and this is not just in my former organization, but also folks in the community that I've talked to or folks who have reached out, especially early on, like saying, I don't really know what's going on. I don't really understand what's going on. And that in and of itself is such a privileged statement, but particularly for folks who work in healthcare, who are in leadership positions in government organizations, I find it really fascinating to say, I don't know what's going on, and I'd rather just kind of sweep it under the rug, as in, this is a PR thing that we just need to like make it go away. And I think that it's surprising when folks make statements about a commitment to equity work or a commitment, as we say, to DEI or EDI. So, and the acronym bothers me quite a lot, but we say, or committed to DEI work, or in my case, it was committed to IDEA work, inclusion, diversity, equity, and accessibility. But what that commitment actually looks and feels like is something that folks do have no comprehension of or do not even want to tread into. Like, they don't even want to wade into the waters of what that actually looks like and what it takes to dismantle intersecting systems of oppression. So I think that's the aspect that's not surprising, but to be so open to say like, oh, this is just uncomfortable, and therefore I'm going to try to sweep it under the rug instead of actually bringing folks in or bringing in perspectives where folks do know what they're talking about and do have thoughts and ideas and perspectives, and also standard approaches and ways of taking space, taking pause, and dealing with these things as appropriately as possible given the times we're living in.
That's a good point you make there about what a commitment to equity would actually look like and what the commitments have been in practice from all these companies. Can you tell me a bit of more about that? What would an ideal commitment to DEI, EDI, equity work look like in this case?
Well, I think it's a good point to raise because we're in a really interesting flux right now when it comes to equity work. We had, the 2020 racial reckoning saw such a huge increase in, at least outward commitments to for organizations to do DEI work, diversity, equity, and inclusion work, and to hire chief equity officers or chief diversity officers or what have you. And we really quickly saw that tailspin back. And for particularly in the States, but also across Canada, for DEI positions to be cut, for DEI funding to dry up, for those portfolios to be scapegoated and for folks to pin problems and issues in human resources and employee experience on DEI portfolios, and then hence to say, well, now it's no longer needed. Such to the point that the Society for Human Resource Management has actually taken equity out of the acronym, and now they're just focusing on diversity and inclusion, which is hilarious because equity is the one piece that actually needs to be focused on in organizations to ensure fairness. And that will, in kind, allow folks to feel like they are included and they belong and that they feel safe to be hired into an organization in the first place, thus like increasing diversity. So it's flabbergasting, really, to think that equity is something that we can get rid of, but that's because it makes people uncomfortable. So we're in a really interesting time right now where we're scapegoating DEI, we're scapegoating DEI leadership. We're seeing that, not just in my case, and other cases like mine in healthcare. This is across Canada. I've had conversations with folks from the National Council of Canadian Muslims, the NCCM, and they said they've seen 5 to 7 cases similar to mine a day since October 7th of employees that are actually being targeted for speaking out, having political voice around anti-Palestinian racism. Yeah, so it's a really rough time. And I think if organizations are actually committed and truly want to eradicate these barriers to equity and to identify what intersecting systems of oppression look like in their organization, they have to be prepared to be very uncomfortable. It's not comfortable work. If you are in a position of power in an organization and you're a cishet white dude, you have got to be prepared to completely have your worldview flipped over. And I don't think most folks in those roles are ready for that. In fact, I can guarantee that the majority of them really don't want to feel that kind of discomfort. But anyone in leadership has to be prepared to say the words, I don't know what I'm talking about. I don't have this lived experience. I have to renege that power to folks who do, who also have the training and expertise to bring in anti-oppressive frameworks, to bring in examples of how we build and measure trust in an organization, and then to go on their own learning journey at the like simultaneously so that they're caught up by the time, say, an equity audit comes through and it says we've got to redo all this policy and they're ready to go. So I think it's ultimately like a lot of change management for organizations to prepare those folks who are in positions of power and privilege to be rocked to their core. And to not let their learning journey stagnate changes to policy and process that we can do tomorrow that actually have a real impact on employee equity or on patient and family equity or the business community, depending on whatever sector you're working in. So it has to happen simultaneously. And I think organizations have been really comfortable with the idea of, an equity calendar where we celebrate Pride and we celebrate Black History Month and we share stories from folks about how they feel, how the Pride Week went this year or something like that. But when it comes to actually digging into policy and process, or listening to folks when they share experiences and saying, okay, I'm going to take that, and the onus of responsibility is going to be on me to change that. Those are the pieces that folks have yet to say, yeah, for sure, I'm in, I'm all in on that. So I think that there's a real difference between lip service and, that tokenization of saying like we're committed to DEI or EDI, and then to actually say we're going to change the foundation of our organization so it sits on a framework of anti-oppression. And I think, why I laugh when I say the acronym is that the problem is we've created these departments or these roles, DEI director, and it's really easy to get rid of DEI or to defund DEI. But when you say diversity, equity, and inclusion, and you use those words, and you realize we're saying, well, let's not resource equity this year. Like, what does that actually feel like? It's absurd. Equity work should be baked into every single aspect of every single organization. It is how we humanize and evolve ourselves past the current state that we find ourselves in. So it's not just about funding a singular position or under-resourcing a portfolio to try to do equity work across an entire organization. It's about actually picking up your process, your human resources department, your clinical education or your healthcare foundation, and putting it back down on a foundation of anti-oppression, a foundation of decolonization, of self-determination, indigenous self-determination, and being like, oh my God, what would that look like? And then you rebuild.
You mentioned that there's essentially a lot of lip service going on in the DEI world, and that has led to practice not really lining up to commitments. For example, you mentioned the 5 to 7 cases of anti-Palestinian racism being seen a day by the National Council of Canadian Muslims. So what do you think this environment that we're in right now, this atmosphere, what does this mean for the future of marginalized workers and specifically Palestinian workers? What direction are we heading in?
It doesn't look good. I like to think the optimist in me likes to think that we are, because of the, I guess, the court of public opinion that we are seeing across the globe, the global majority, the outcry against this anti-Palestinian racism, anti-Muslim racism, anti-Arab racism that we're seeing across the board. I like to think that it's going to push organizations, the public sector, to actually shifting practice. It doesn't feel like that right now. However, there are marked examples of organizations setting precedent to change this. In British Columbia, the Provincial Health Services Authority had a number of folks come to their CEO with concern about what actually happened to me. And their CEO committed to changing employee conduct policy so that folks can show up authentically and as themselves and express themselves and their political and cultural viewpoints. So we do see examples of changes and shifts happening like that, but I don't think that we're on a downhill slide in any way at this point. I think if anything, what we're seeing and what, the protests and the organizing community is showing us and has been showing us for a while is that we can take aspects of the organizing and advocacy world and bring it into the workplace. Things like mutual aid and transformative or restorative justice, collective liberation, those are things, practices that in some cases have been brought into the workplace, but I think can really be cemented because anybody who's worked in an organization and has an ERG for 2SLGBTQIA plus folks or, a union group that is committed to equity or, stewards for DEI or what have you, those are really the best outlets for felt change. That organizing on the ground, introducing new process, practicing small elements of restorative justice in your HR practices, or, in my world in healthcare, physicians and patients working together to work in a new way and bring in new ways of knowing and being. I think those are the pieces that I have the most optimism about. And in terms of the folks who are continuously oppressed and who are, the Palestinian diaspora who are, concerned about their families and their lives, like that's where community wraps around them. And you can find community in the workplace, but, that's where those of us who don't have that experience need to step up and say, what do you need? What would safety feel like? What does it look like if it's good? And what do I have to offer? Is that money? Is that time? Is it food? Is it my voice? Is it, taking one for the team and filing a lawsuit and going to court or taking something to the Human Rights Tribunal because you can, because you potentially have that privilege or that financial autonomy to say, like, okay, I could potentially not work for 6 months if it means bringing voice to something like this.
You've mentioned you've worked in equity work for a long time, specifically in a more, I guess, like professional setting, like within organizations, industries, like as your job. But you're also mentioning now things like the organizing on the ground, which are not necessarily, people's jobs or employment. So for you, as someone who's done this kind of work, what does the future look like? Do you think the future lies within having these professional positions that are equity focused, or within organizing on the ground, or a bit of both? What does it look like?
Well, the future is collective liberation. So I think that our liberation as a society comes from that organization, that community, and that collective on the ground. And I believe that, with every fiber of my being. I think that how we are in the world is how we show up in the work. And so the more that folks gain a comfort level with activism and organizing, which are two different things, they're parallel paths, but they are two different roles, and find their niche in that world of, like, what does a revolution require? It requires the nurses and the bakers and the folks on the front line and the folk musicians, and it requires all of us, all roles. The more comfortable we find in that place, in that community, working towards collective liberation, educating towards collective liberation, the more we'll bring that to the workplace and demand it and know what it feels like to have it be successful. I don't think we're in a place, and I don't think we will be in a place for decades where we can actually get rid of equity-focused roles in organizations. How they do their work needs to change. But until we get to that place where folks see it as just the way that things have to be, we're going to have structured, organized positions and hopefully highly resourced portfolios that are focused on doing that work with people in roles that know what they're talking about, have the education, and they have the lived experience to bring the right perspectives to that work. So I think it's going to be a marriage of both, but yeah, I think our saving grace is in that, is in on the ground organizing and the collective liberation.
Thank you so much for joining us on Rabble Radio today. That is all the time we had, but I think I learned a lot about the field of EDI in the workplace. Thank you so much.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for having me.
That was Rabble labor reporter Gabriella Kaluge-Kasuga and Amy Blanding in conversation. Thanks so much for that, Amy and Gabby. And now, this is our In Case You Missed It segment, where we review the top stories from this week on Rabble.ca. Here to bring us up to date is Rabble editor Nick Seabrook. Over to you, Nick.
Thanks, Brianne. This week in national news, a collective of Jewish groups and supporters calling for peace in the Middle East held a demonstration on Parliament Hill on Tuesday, December 3rd. Hundreds of demonstrators swarmed the Confederation Building, where MPs' offices are located. Demonstrators were members of groups that opposed the Israeli government's apartheid policies towards Palestinians. Groups represented at the demonstration included Independent Jewish Voices Canada, If Not Now, and Jews Say No to Genocide. The protesters demanded that Canada end all arms shipments to Israel. Since the attack on Israel on October 7, 2023, by the Palestinian group Hamas, Israel has bombed Palestinian Gaza, killing over 40,000 civilians. This week, Amnesty International released a report calling Israel's actions in Gaza a genocide. In economic news, food banks in Ontario are seeing drastically rising demand for their services. There were approximately 500,000 visits to the Ottawa Food Bank last year, a 90% increase since pre-pandemic levels in 2019. This increased demand on food banks has led 40% of all food banks in Ontario to reduce the amount of food they give to their members in order to keep up with demand. Ricardo Trangin, a senior researcher on housing and social policy with the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives, points to rising housing costs as one factor leading people to rely more on food banks. The average cost of rent in Canada was $2,152 in October of this year. And finally, as we near the end of the 16 days of activism against gender-based violence, a new study shows rising instances of violence in predominantly female workplaces. A survey completed by the Ontario Secondary School Teachers Federation shows that 75% of its members believe there has been an increase in violent incidents since their careers began. As well, almost one-third of surveyed respondents had violence used against them. The Canadian Union of Public Employees, CUPE, released a worker-led report in September, which showed school support workers bore the brunt of this violence. In a statement, the Federal Office of the Minister for Women and Gender Equality and Youth said the government recognizes gender-based violence as a pervasive issue and that the government was developing a national plan to reduce workplace violence and support victims. And as always, you can read the full version of all the stories we talked about today on Rabble.ca.
Thanks, Nick. And that's it for Rabble Radio this week. Thanks as always for tuning in. If you like the show, please consider subscribing to Rabble Radio on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please rate, review, share Rabble Radio with your friends. It takes 2 seconds to support independent media like Rabble. Thank you to all the journalists and writers who contributed to this week's content on Rabble.ca, and thank you to Carl Nirenberg for supplying the music. Lastly, thank you to you for tuning in to Rabble Radio. I'm Brianne Doyle, and I'll talk to you next week.